His life has to be characterized by meditation, contemplation, transcendence. L'chu l'mayim, go learn Torah. Go learn about two people fighting over a talis, and this one says that the talis belongs to me, this one says the talis belongs to me. That is the wisdom of Hashem. That's how you'll connect to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, like the Alter Rebbe explained in chapters 4 and 5, that learning Torah could be about a mundane halacha. Could be about an exchange of a cow with a donkey. It could be about an unpaid guardian or a paid guardian who's denying that he was negligent in guarding your animal or your vessel. This is Mayim, this is Teira. This is the means to connect with HaKadosh Baruch. So you have the tzaddikim indeed, who their divine worship is characterized by this desire to quench this deep thirst and to connect to HaKadosh Baruch. But the men of ascent, however, the Bnei Haliyah, whom we've been discussing now, are beyond this level of divine service. They do not study Torah or perform mitzvahs with the mere intention of quenching their own thirst for godliness. Such service ultimately, as we shall soon see in a subtle sense, is ultimately self-serving. It's motivated by one's desire for a certain spiritual profit, for a certain spiritual bliss, the bliss of closeness to Hashem. The Bnei Aliyah is the man whose whole avodah is directed towards Lamaila, not for himself, not even for his spiritual self, not even for his godly self. It's L'tzoris Gavoya, for the sake of HaKadosh Baruch. What does it mean? What does it mean is avodah is for the sake of HaKadosh Baruch? So the Alter Rebbe explains, Ela k'dipir shubetikunim. Rather, their service to Av Hashem is as the Tikkuni Zohar explains, that which our sages have said, Ezel chassid amis chassidim kainai. Who is a pious one? Who is a chassid? He who is benevolent with his Creator. So the Tikkuni Zohar interprets it in kandilei. Kainai literally means his Creator. It could also mean with his nest. Kan means a nest. He is benevolent with his nest. What does this mean? Uniting the Holy One, blessed be He, says the Tikkun Zayir, with His Shechina, the Divine Presence, in the lowly worlds. In many Jewish communities, before a mitzvah is performed, a prayer, a short prayer is said, which begins with the words, before some mitzvah, number one, L'shem Yichud Kutshebrichu Shchinte. This mitzvah is being done in order to unify Kutshebrichu and Shchinte. What's the problem? Kutshebrichu and Shchinte are not in speaking terms. What do we have to unify exactly? Other communities don't say it before other mitzvahs, before Baruch Sha'amar, even in Nusach Ha'ari, L'shem Yichud Kutshebrichu Shchinte. L'yachta Shem Yudke V'vavke B'yichud Shlim, in the name of all the Jewish people, a complete unity between Kodesh Brichu and Shchinte. Kan, nest. A bird who soars, a bird who flies, its nest is its abode. Its abode on earth, that is its nest. When you talk about HaKadosh Baruch Hu, anthropomorphically, there are two aspects to the expression of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. There is the Eibishter, Hashem's manifested presence within this world. That's what's called Kandilei, his nest. His enclosement, his manifestation. Within our universe's reality, he enclosing himself in that reality, that is called Kandilei, the nest of the Shechina. The nest of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and that's defined as Shechina. Shechina, the etymology of the word is indwelling. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's manifested presence within our reality that suits itself with the nature of our world, that is the Shechina. Then there is Kodesh Baruch Hu, that is the transcendental reality of Hashem. So you have Kodesh Baruch Hu, the transcendental reality, and Shechinti, the manifested reality within this world. The purpose of creation is liyachada kutshebrichu shchinte. The ultimate true reality is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the only real reality. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu essentially transcends every type of parameter and definition. That's Kutcha Brichu. But He created a world and He manifests Himself within the definitions and within the characteristics of the world. That's a whole other reality. It's not transcendental. On the contrary, it's manifested. The human being's challenges to create a link and a bond between Kutcha Brichu and Shechinta, yes, there's an inherent dichotomy. Our world is defined by definition, by limitation, by boundary. The Jew comes and creates a union between the transcendental God and the manifested God, so to speak, or in other words, between an undefined state of reality and a defined state of reality, thus creating a link between ultimate truth and defined limited reality and crossing the gulf between them, uniting them into a seamless whole. And that's the greatest achievement of creation, because ultimately, what can we achieve? What do we achieve with our lives? What do we achieve? The fact that we generate some money, some power, some honor, fine, nice thing, but ultimately it's hollow. So ultimately what we can contribute is something that's really true. So the humanity contributes something that's not just true, it's the most powerful thing. Before the world was created, it was Kutcha Brichu. Hashem created a world and introduced the idea of Shechinteh. A whole new reality which blurs and compromises, so to speak, that transcendence. And the Jew comes and permeates this truth within a physical fragmented world, that this fragmentation is allowed by Shechina, which allows for division and limitedness. Before we do a mitzvah, we say, L'shem yichud kutcha brichu shechinte. What's a mitzvah? A mitzvah is a flow of energy from kutcha brichu reality into shechinte reality. Mitzvah is usually translated as commandment. Commandment. Mitzvah has another meaning. Tzafsa. A link, a bond. Before, when a Jew does a mitzvah is Hashem's will. Hashem in His transcendental self wants this to be done. So when the Jew does a mitzvah, he creates a link between kutcha brichu and shechinte. So this tzaddik, his divine service is l'tzayach gavay. It's not merely that he should be connected. Rather, what his soul concern is that Hashem's purpose in creation should be realized. L'yachad the kutcha brichu shechinte, that kutcha brichu and shechinte should be unified. Not because he wants to connect. Not because he wants to be perfected. Not because he doesn't want to be thirsty. But he's absolutely selfless. He cares about one thing, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu's purpose in creation should be realized, should be fulfilled. And that's what the Bnei Aliyah are. U'kamesh kasev b'Raya Mehemna Parsha Seitzei. As is also explained in Raya Mehemna and Parsha Seitzei. Ki b'rad ishtadol basar avi v'imei. In the manner of a son who exerts himself for his father and mother, whom he loves more than himself, more than his own nefesh, his own ruach, his own neshama, and who sacrifices his life for their sake to redeem them, should they be held in captivity, as is also explained elsewhere. He's not giving all his money to redeem them. Then he will at least have the enjoyment of seeing them. He sacrifices his life that they should be redeemed. He doesn't even gain anything out of it personally. He won't be there to celebrate their liberation, their redemption. But he's a child, and this is his father and mother. So his love to them transcends his himself. Not only his physical self, even his spiritual self. And he'll do anything just to redeem them. The Shechina is in Galus. The Shechina is in exile. The divine manifested presence, reality, is in exile. It's an exile within our world. The Bnei Aliyah are concerned with redeeming the Shechina from its exile. In other words, creating a bond between Kutcha Brichu and Shechinte by imbuing our world with the Kutcha Brichu reality and thus creating that ultimate link between the undefined state of Kutcha Brichu and the defined state of Shechina. So this is the second reason and the second interpretation in the concept of Bnei Aliyah. I want to conclude the perek. We'll just another few minutes. I want to conclude the perek because parentheses. But I just want to convey one point over here to understand what Alter Rebbe is saying a little clear, a bit more clear, with a story. This occurred in 1910. The Russian government, Tsarist government at the time, was before the revolution, 7 years, attempted to issue forth a decree which would create serious changes and limitations on Jewish education, both for young children and for adults, for rabbinical education. They wanted to control the education of the Jewish youth and the rabbinate in order that it should be consistent with what they wanted, not with what the Torah wanted. So they wanted to create serious changes in the whole educational system, that one, in order for one, for example, to serve as a rabbi of a community, he has to go through the whole Russian secular education. Thus, they felt they can influence the whole future of Jewish cultural, religious, and spiritual life. So the great leaders of Russian Jewry at the time gathered at an emergency meeting that took place in the capital, which was Petersburg at the time, Petersburg, in 1910 to discuss the issue. The two towering forces, pillars that attended that meeting, among other many rabbis and scholars, were the great leaders, sages of their time, Reb Chaim Brisker, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik was the Rav of the Lithuanian city Brisk, following his position as Rosh Yeshiva of the Volozhiner Yeshiva, one of the greatest minds of the past generation. He passed away 8 years later in 1918, which means that this year is the 80th anniversary of his passing. And a very close friend, colleague of his, the fifth Lubavitcher Rebbe, Reb Shalom Ber Shneyerson. Those two would often meet and discuss issues that were facing, problems that were facing Russian Jewry at the time. The Russian government sent a representative to the meeting, of course in disguise, to see what's going on. Now, this was a very serious decree, and they threatened that if the rabbis are going to fight it, they will legally allow pogroms in every city to kill the Jews. So it was literally an issue of life and death. They said that they are going to encourage pogroms in every city, major cities. And most rabbis were absolutely in despair. What can you do? Fight the government. Go fight City Hall. It was a Tsarist government. It wasn't a democracy. The Rebbe Rashab, as he is known, Reb Shalom Ber, got up and he spoke. And the point of his speech was, he said, among other things, only, he says, not through our will were we placed in exile, not through our will and through our own energies will we leave exile, galus. Hashem placed us in exile and He will redeem us. However, this every human being living on the face of this earth should know, that only our bodies have been sent to exile. Our souls were never sent to exiles. Our spirits, our neshamis, our nefashis, are not in galus. He said the thousands of years of Jewish pride and mesiras nefesh come to the fore today when we declare al tigul b'mashichai, do not touch, do not taint the spirit of the Jewish people. And he gave a fiery speech, at which conclusion he fainted from his deep emotion. He fainted, they revived him, and they arrested him. Reb Chaim came in the evening to visit the Rebbe. They allowed him to visit the Rebbe. Reb Chaim walked in, and the Rebbe was sitting and weeping bitterly. So Reb Chaim says in Yiddish, Lubavitcher Rebbe, was veinter? Why are you crying? We did everything that we can. Now it's up to Hashem. So why are you bitter? It's not as if we did not do what we could. We did everything we can. And the Rebbe continued to cry, and he said, Reb Chaim, you're right. Aber der Inyan hat sich nicht aufgetan. We did everything we can. But the mission was not accomplished. And he told him a metaphor. He says, you have an employer and an employee. And the employee is a very loyal, honest, and sincere person. And he works loyally, he puts in his hours, really with concern for his employer and for the business. You come in the middle of the day, and the business is going fine. You won't recognize the difference between the employer and the employee if you do not know, because they're both giving it all they got. Even if the business is going not so well, and you come in the middle of working hours, you won't recognize the difference. The employer is working with all his might, and the employee, a faithful human being, is doing whatever he can to fulfill his job faithfully. And you do not see any difference between them. We're not dealing with an employee who every 2 minutes goes for lunch and for a telephone call and this. A real employee. So when do you see the difference? He says, by night. They come home, and the business is not going so well. The employee worked his whole day, and he did whatever he can. But he comes home, he eats dinner, he does what he has to do, and then he goes to sleep, and he sleeps tranquilly and peacefully. The business is getting the air there, and it's going down the drain. True. Tomorrow morning, again, he'll rededicate himself. But what does it have to do with his sleeping? His sleeping, it's not part of his schedule to work there at the time of his sleep, and it's not going to help. Over here, you recognize the balabas, the employer, the one who owns the business. His supper is not a supper, and his sleeping is not a sleeping. He's dreaming about his thing, his business. Why? What does it help dreaming about it? You can't do anything. You're doing everything you can. You're right. But it's his thing. It's his thing. He owns it. It belongs to him. So he cannot tear away his mind, his soul from it. The employee works for it. He gives everything he got, but he and the thing are two separate entities. So there is day and there is night. There is work and there is sleep. It's two realities. The other human being, this is who I am. So when I sleep, it's me. When I eat, it's me. When I drink, it's me. And if the business is going bad, I can't do anything else. So the Rebbe Rashab said, Hashem has a lot of employees. The whole world are supposed to be his employees. Some are faithful, some are loyal, and some are not loyal. The loyal employee is loyal. He really cares for it. And he'll do everything he can to help the situation, to get Hashem's job done in the world. And what if he does everything he can, and he can't do anything more? Nope. I didn't do it. It's not my problem. So he could go on. But what about if it's you? When Hashem's mission becomes you, becomes your identity, when your eye is not an eye, when your whole eye, your whole ego is nothing but an expression, a mirror of the divine eye, of the divine reality. So if Hashem's mission was not achieved, was not accomplished, how can I not cry? It's not an issue if he's guilty or not guilty, in other words. If he's going to get Gan Eden or not get Gan Eden. Of course he'll get Gan Eden. That's not the issue. But the inyan of tzich nishtab getan. The mission was not accomplished. It's not my fault, it's God's problem. But if God's problem becomes me, so it's my problem. This is the real tzaddik. The real tzaddik is a human being who is nefesh alikis. The divine reality that exists within the Jew has pervaded his entire being, his entire character. So his self is an exercise, a perpetual exercise in selflessness. His self, his sense of I, is a glimmer, is an expression of the divine I. So his whole agenda, what motivates him in every aspect and moment of his life, is not personal fulfillment, personal perfection. Not Eilam Haba and not Gan Eden. Not Schar and not even connection with Hashem, the Alter Rebbe is saying. He has reached such a state of selflessness that what matters to him is one thing. HaKadosh Baruch Hu's Ratzon, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's will. And I'll give everything away for that. Reb Nachum Chernobyler was one of the Talmidim, the students of the Baal Shem Tov, and he came to a city. There was no mikveh in the city. So he asked the Jews, why is there no ritual bath in the city? He said, we can't afford it, it's a poor community. There's one very wealthy individual, but he's stingy, he won't give a penny for it. So Reb Nachum went up on the bimah. And he said, "I need how much?" He asked them, "How much do you need?" 20,000 rubles. Gets up on the bima when everyone was there in shul, and he says, "I want to sell my portion in Olam Haba for 20,000 rubles. Is anyone interested in buying it?" This guy was stingy, but he knew that ultimately it pays 20,000 rubles. It pays. Reb Nachum Chernobyler's place in Olam Haba, nishgeferlich. Yeah, it won't do you bad, even al hasafek, even if you didn't believe in Olam Haba. Ahamaskim, he gave him 20,000 rubles, they signed a contract, and the mikveh was built. So he loses his Olam Haba. What is it all about? He worked and worked and worked for Olam Haba. Yeah, that ultimately after my soul passes on, I should experience an eternal bliss. But if the Jewish mother doesn't have a mikveh, he doesn't need his Olam Haba. If Hashem is not going to be a reality in this world, so everything else is meaningless to him. So he gives away his Olam Haba. He won't have anything. But there'll be a mikveh. Hashem's will be fulfilled in the world. This is the Ben Aliyah, the Alter Rebbe says. And this is also the two dimensions that characterizes a Ben Aliyah. A, that he transforms his negativity into positivity, his nefesh ha-bahamas into a nefesh ha-likis, into holiness, and B, that his whole avodah is for the sake of fulfilling Hashem's mission. These two things, these two reasons, correspond to the two titles, Tzadik v'Tovloi and Tzadik Gomer. Tzadik v'Tovloi, which denotes that he has no evil because it has been transformed, corresponds to the interpretation of Bnei Aliyah that he was Maila Dira. Tzadik Gomer, which means that his relationship with Hashem, in a positive sense, is par excellence, exemplifies and expresses itself in the second interpretation of Bnei Aliyah, that his Aveda is selfless. And these two things meet in one human being's heart and mind. As long as the Tzadik has an iota of the Nefesh HaBahamas remain within him, so then ultimately his avodah cannot be selfless, because there's a self embedded there. In the conscious, or not in the conscious, in the subconscious. So ultimately the I is still buried. So of course his avodah is not for the sake of arrogance. That's not a tzaddik. That's not even a beinoni. Avodah is to connect to Hashem. But it's ultimately, I want to connect to Hashem. Let's not underestimate that desire, that thirst. He realizes what the Ribbono Shel Olam is, and his whole life is characterized by fulfilling that yearning. But ultimately, it's a taiva. It's a personal desire, it's a taiva. It's a taiva that in order to experience that taiva, you first have to lose all other taivas. Such tama taiva. In order to experience this yearning, this temptation to connect to Hashem, you have to lose all other temptations. They simply don't coexist. But nonetheless, it's a taiva. It's a godly one. The Tzadik Gomer, he was mahapech derah. Like the first interpretation of Bnei Aliyah. So there's no I. The whole I has become an exercise in the nefesh ha-likis. So his whole life, yeah, is a perpetual expression of one thing. What HaKadosh Baruch Hu desires. What is emes, because it's emes. Totally beyond the parameters of a self and an ego. Let's mamash finish the next few lines. It's already late. Huh? Yeah. I just want to finish the perek. Ushneim oilim bekanach. Both interpretations are complementary. Both interpretations of Bnei Aliyah are complementary. They accord with each other, and they both ultimately convey one point. For by refining the good found in Klipas Noiga and the translucent shell, Mailim Mein Nukvin, one elevates feminine waters. V'nasim yichudim el yoinim lahirid mayin duchrin, effecting unions in the higher realms so as to cause masculine waters to ascend. Masculine waters to descend. Shehem heim mei mei hachasadim shebechol mitzvah mitzvah meramach mitzvah saseh. These masculine waters are the waters of kindness that flow into and are contained in each of the 248 positive commandments, shekulon ein pchinas chasadim umayinduch, which are all in the nature of kindness and masculine waters. Waters, dahainu amshachas gedushas alakusa yizbarch, milmaila lamata leislabish betachtainim kameshekosov makamach. This term, masculine waters, as applies to mitzvahs, means that the mitzvahs draw Hashem's holiness from above, from the higher realms downward, so that Hashem's holiness be clothed in and revealed within the lowest realms, as explained elsewhere. This sentence, which is in parentheses, in this sentence, the Alter Rebbe employs as obvious Kabbalistic terms, but just briefly, in a moment, what he's saying is as follows. The connection between the two interpretations of Bnei Aliyah is not just in the sense that the human being is the one who connects them. In other words, the one who has transformed his Nefesh HaBahamis into Kedusha is the one who manages to attain and experience the art of selflessness. So it's the human being in which the two interpretations are connected. He's saying more than that. The two interpretations are connected by their very content. There is a concept in Kabbalah of feminine energy, masculine energy, physically expressed in feminine reproductive substances and masculine reproductive substances. The feminine called Mayin Nukvin, feminine waters. The masculine called Mayin Dchurin, masculine waters. Masculine waters are exemplified. Masculine waters are connected with the flow, giving. Feminine energy receives, becomes a vessel to receive that flow, incorporate it, digest it, ingest it, and develop it. The arousal of the feminine energy is often what initiates the flow from the masculine energy. It's not just there is a masculine flow, and then the feminine comes into flow, feminine energy comes to receive it. It's often begins, it's initiated by the feminine arousal, which causes the flow from the masculine energy. The same is true in the spiritual sense, in the relationship between the flow from above, from Hashem's reality called Mayin Tchurin, and the receptacle that humanity creates called Mayin Nukvin. That it is the arousal from the feminine energy, from the feminine waters, that creates, that initiates the flow from above. Sometimes there is a flow and then the Mayin Nukvin come into the picture. But very often, in order to create that flow from Mayin Tchurin, what happens first, there has to be the arousal from Mayin Nukvin, which then in turn creates the connection and the descent from Mayin Tchurin into Mayin Nukvin. Which means in man's relationship with Hashem, that often we have to create the arousal, and the very arousal from the feminine energy is what creates and initiates the masculine flow. In this sense, the first interpretation of Bnei Aliyah is that the tzaddik managed to transform this world into holiness, to take the Nefesh HaBahamas and to elevate it. He has managed to take something from Klipa and be it mevarer, refine it, elevate it, extract its inner potential and godly spark, and bring it up to its source. So this is actually the effort of man to rise upwards. It's an arousal of the Mayin Nukvin, of the feminine waters. That's the first aspect of Bnei Aliyah. Transform the lowly realm into holiness. That's man's effort to bring up, to elevate the world. So what does that do? That creates a union in the higher realms between the masculine and the feminine, and it causes the masculine waters to descend. That Kodesh Baruch Hu should descend in Shchinte, which is the second interpretation of Bnei Aliyah. And these are the waters in every mitzvah. As mentioned before, the mitzvahs we say, L'shem Yichud Kodesh Baruch Hu Shchinte, because it's the mitzvah that is that flow of energy. The mitzvah comes from the Kodesh Baruch Hu reality. So mitzvahs are characterized by waters of benevolence, because they flow from the Kodesh Baruch Hu, from the essence of Hashem. And this actually draws down and brings the transcendental holiness of Hashem in our physical and mundane world. So it's not just the two interpretations of Bnei Aliyah are in the same person. The very concept is interconnected. By transforming the evil into Kedusha, the very other mission is accomplished. The other interpretation of Bnei Aliyah is that the whole purpose is L'yachad HaKodesh Baruch Hu Shchintei B'tachtonim. That happens through the arousal of Mayin Nukvin that initiates the draw of holiness from Mayin Tchurin, from Kodesh Baruch Hu, to descend and imbue our world with godliness, thus fulfilling the mission of Hashem, which is that our world, our fragmented physical world, should become one and unified with the transcendental absolute reality of Hashem. What is the source for the expression Al Masela Hach Vayetsu Mayim? You have a siddur? Give me a siddur, please. On the holiday of Shmini Atzeres during Musaf, there's a special prayer recited for rain. It's called Tfilas Geshem. There, we, the Jewish people, beseech Hashem for a year of plenty, for a winter, a fall of rain, and so forth. And we make mention of the unique merits achieved by the giants of our history in connection with water. We make mention, for example, of the fact that the news that Yitzchak, that Isaac will be born, came about when Avraham, when his father Abraham, offered a little bit of water to his three guests, the three angels that came to visit him. He said, Yukach nama atmayim. We make mention of the fact that Yitzchak dug and found wells of water, that Yaakov removed a rock from a well of water, that Yaakov battled with an angel who was a composite of fire and water, and so on and so forth. And then we come to Moshe Rabbeinu. We discuss Avraham and Yitzchak and Yaakov and their connection to water. And then we come to Moshe Rabbeinu, and we say that Moshe was placed into water by his mother, and then he was taken out of water. That Moshe nourished Jethro's flock with water. And then we continue, Zgulecha esamu l'mayim ala sela hach v'yetzumayim. Zgulecha, your chosen ones, your chosen people, the holy nation of Israel. The time when they were thirsty for water, ala sela hach, he struck the rock v'yetzumayim, and out came water. That is the source for this expression. Yes. That's a good question. Maybe you're saying Al Asela Hach Vayetsu Mayim is referring to the first time Moshe struck the rock in Parshas B'Shalach, when it was indeed a positive thing. I brought out the fact that we praise Moshe with the fact that Allah Sala Hach Vayetsu Mayim is considered a merit, and we even made a fabulous melody to the words. You're saying Moshe hit the rock another time. Everybody knows when the Jews came out of Egypt, they were thirsty for water. This is in Parshas B'Shalach. So Hashem tells Moshe to strike the rock. V'hikisa v'atzur, you should strike the rock. And water will come forth, and from it the people will drink. And that was indeed a positive thing. Hashem told him to do it. Hashem told him to strike the rock, to strike the tzur. Maybe that's what it's talking about, Al Asela Hach Vayetsu Mayim. But that's not true. It's referring to the time Moshe struck the Moshe hit the rock in Parshas Chukas. After the passing of Miriam, close to the end of the 40-year stay of the Jewish people in the desert. Almost 40 years after the incident in Parshas B'Shalach. And for that striking the rock, he was punished not to enter into the Holy Land. How do I know? Nuzag. How do I know it's referring to that one? Because the expression we use in Tfilas Gashem is Al HaSelach Atazeh. Very good. Al HaSelach VaYetzumayim. He struck the Sela. In B'Shalach it says V'Yikisav Atzur. And there are important differences between a Sela and a Tzur discussed in the commentaries. For example, what? Tzur is large and Tzur is very hard. Tzur is rock hard. Sela is not close as hard as a rock, as a Tzur. If we were referring to that story, we should have said, Al Atzur Hach VaYetzumayim. We say Al HaSelach. Yes. Why did Moshe strike and not talk to the rock? As I mentioned before, now this is not the time to discuss the issue. It's a separate sugya. It's discussed elsewhere in Kabbalah and in Chassidus and so forth. But since you mentioned already the first time that Moshe was told to strike the rock in Parshas B'Shalach, I'll share with you just a short thought. I think it's from the Be'er Mayim Chaim, from Reb Chaim Chernovitcher, the holy Reb Chaim Chernovitcher. On this issue, not just because it's a beautiful idea, also because this is a theme which is extremely central to the thesis of the Tanya. You see, apparently, the story in Parshas B'Shalach makes this incident in Parshas Chukas so much more puzzling. Hashem has told Moshe in the past to strike the rock, V'yikisav Atzur. Then it was a mitzvah. Now, it was a devastating transgression. Hashem tells him to talk to the rock, to communicate to it verbally. Instead, Moshe goes and hits the rock. So Rashi says, because of that, Moshe was punished not to enter into the Holy Land. Moshe had a powerful precedent. Hashem told him to hit the rock. So what is going on? First of all, why didn't Hashem want that he should strike the rock here? If striking the rock is such a terrible thing, why did he tell him in the past to strike the rock? Even if for whatever reason Hashem did not want him to strike the rock here, why was it such a devastating transgression? And the next issue we don't understand is, why indeed would Moshe strike the rock? What's the big deal? What type of evil inclination, supposedly, would Moshe have embedded within him that would urge him, hey Moshe, you don't hit the rock, strike the rock. You'll have a lot more pleasure when you strike the rock. Just one little idea, one short, beautiful idea. I think the Be'er Mayim Chaim says it. There are two ways to communicate to an individual whom you want to produce water. Water of wisdom, water of spirituality, water of godliness. One is through striking him with a staff, and one is through communicating to him verbally. The former method is a rigorous method, which is employed in some literature of Judaism, especially in some books of Musar, of ethics. It's called the Musar way. You admonish the individual. You demonstrate to him how devastating, how terrible, how horrendous his behavior is. You show him how heinous his crimes are. What he's doing to himself, to his life, to his people, to his family. You describe to him the awful punishments that await him in the world to come. And how he will be doomed through his sins and his transgressions and his violations and so forth. Basically, you hit him, you strike him with a staff. In a tough way. You show him how terrible he is, how terrible his acts are, how his life is, and so forth. And as a result of that, you hope that he will become terrified, awesomely terrified, from doing, from indulging in things he was previously, and he will start producing fresh water. This is the method of striking the rock. But then there's another method. You talk to the rock. A person is sometimes like a rock. A person sometimes turns into a rock. His mind becomes a rock. His heart becomes a rock. He's insensitive. He's unreceptive. He does not feel. He doesn't experience sensitivity, vulnerability, the spirituality, love, passion, ecstasy. He's a rock. So you could strike the rock and then you can talk to the rock. You talk to the human being. You demonstrate to him the depth of goodness and spirituality and holiness that's embedded within him. You explain to him the graciousness, the sacredness, the godliness of his soul, of his consciousness. The inner dignity and regality that is at the root of his own essence and his own psyche. You explain to him how he has the ability to become a partner with God in creation, to make a revolution in the world and make this world a godly place, restore reality to what it truly is. You show him how he's essentially an aristocrat, a prince, a son of a king. How his behavior should be a behavior in which he is loyal to himself, to his regal self, to his royal self, to his spiritual self. You communicate with the rock. You cultivate the rock, and then it also produces water. The second approach is the real approach we are to take. That is the way to go. Why? Not only because it's more effective, also because it's the truth. It's more real. That is the truth. A human being is spiritual. A human being is holy. A human being is good. A human being is godly. We discussed last week what the Tzemach Tzedek told her Pesach Malostavke. Pesach, you have such a holy soul. Mamish part of Hashem's reality. So you are in love with an apple. That is true. A Jew is a chelik l'kamim mamish. That's a continuous theme in the Tanya. You have to know who you are. You have to know the preciousness of your soul, the value of yourself. Don't abuse it. Don't mistreat it. Don't reject it. Don't treat it like a piece of dirt. It's not. You're holy. You're sacred. You're godly. You're spiritual. You're beautiful. Live a life which is an expression of your inner glory. So the real way is to talk to the rock, not to strike it. But then sometimes the rock is not a seller, the rock is a tsur, it's much harder than a seller. And it's unreceptive to any type of message. And then sometimes the only message is breaking it, devastating it. That's the only way that you can awake its inner soul. There's no other method. You see, sometimes people, Nebuch, become so fried. They fry their brain through various substances and so forth, that the only remedy is that they hit rock bottom sometimes. Rock bottom, tsur bottom. So when the Jews come out of Egypt, in Parshas B'Shalach, they just came out of Egypt. They were enslaved for 210 years in one of the most lowly places in the universe. Egypt was a pagan land, a very unethical land. The behavioral patterns of Egypt from a Jewish point of view were totally repulsive, and the Jewish people were there for more than 200 years. They were affected in a very deep way. The exodus of Egypt exemplified the beginning of their liberation, physical liberation, but also psychological and emotional and spiritual liberation and freedom from the psychological abuse and distortion which Egypt personified and represented. So when the Jews immediately come out of Egypt, the story in Parshas Bishlach occurs a few weeks after their exodus, before the Torah was given, in Rephidim, before Torah was given, before they even received their mandate as a Jewish nation. Here Hashem tells Moshe, strike the Tzur. The way to inspire the Jewish people at this stage in their psychological and personal development is by a staff. Yes, there is a toughness that's required. There's a certain rigorousness that's required. There's a certain strength, severity, power that is required in order to shape the human being up in the stage. But 40 years later, 40 years of wandering in the desert, of bathing in the waters of spirituality, of being submerged in godliness and holiness and sacredness. Now, when the human being turns into a rock, because that's the struggle of life, a man turns into a rock, to strike the rock, it's a pasnish. After 40 years, it can't. Hashem expected that now finally we can talk to the rock. You could communicate to the rock. Yes. I'll show you, it's in Rashi. What is the source of the expression of Moshe Hayaraya? Ah, you thought I meant. No, it's. There's Moshe Hayaraya with an ayin in Parshas Shmos. Moshe Hayaraya, Moshe was a shepherd. He shepherded the flock of his father-in-law Yisrael. I meant another Moshe Hayaraya. Rashi in the beginning of Parshas Korach, the Medrash Tanchuma and Rashi brings in the beginning of Parshas Korach. Naftali, give me a chumash, please. Parshas Korach, Zakt Rashi. Korach shepikechayon. Korach was a wise man. Maral ishtuze. Why did he act so foolishly to rebel against Moshe and Aaron? Zakt Rashi, einav. Where is the Rashi here? Einav itasai. Einav itasai. Korach made an error. His eye caused him to error. His perception was somewhat distorted. What was his error? Korach saw prophetically that among his offspring there would be the prophet Shmuel, Samuel, who was as great in his time as Moses and Aaron combined, as Moshe and Aaron combined. Moshe v'Aaron v'chayanav v'Shmuel b'Korach Shema, it says in Tillim, Tzadik Tas. We say it every Friday night. Korach also saw 24 groups of Levites who would be prophets, who would say Nevuah and would be permeated with the spirit of holiness. Seeing this, Korach was sure that he would triumph over Moshe and Aaron because he saw that these people would be among his offspring. Zakht Rashi, but Korach made a mistake. Leira Yafe. He failed to have a perfect vision and perception of the future. Why? Because his sons did tshuva, and he failed to see that. His children did tshuva, they repented. While he never did tshuva, and he would disappear into oblivion, Rashi says. And Rashi continues and concludes, O Moshe Hayaraya! But Moshe saw. Moshe saw. Because it's Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu sees. That's Moshe. Yes. Speak up. I can't hear everything. Please speak up. The Nusach. Good, thank you. Yeah, you're right. You're saying, I said before that according to the Nusach of the Arizal, we say l'shem yichud kutshabrichu shchinte only prior to Baruch Shamar. You're saying it's incorrect. saying L'shem Yichud only prior to Baruch Shamar is the Nusach Chabad, instituted by the Alter Rebbe, which was based on the Nusach of the Arizal. That's correct, thank you. Yes? Okay, now one last question. No.
If a tzaddik can't sin, where is his bechira? Where is his free choice? And in this world, we know that you must have free choice. The next world, we know there's no free choice. But in this world, doesn't every human being, even including the tzaddik, have bechira? If he can't sin, where's his bechira?
You're asking a good question. It's impossible, you're saying, to even entertain the thought that a tzaddik cannot sin, because if so, he doesn't have free choice. He can't sin. And that's a must in this world. Only in the next world don't we have free choice. But in this world, everyone has free choice. So I'll tell you. The issue you bring up, as of itself, the issue of Bechira, that doesn't perturb me. Because we'll see in chapter 14, that a tzaddik, and that is a tzaddik in its ultimate definition. We're not referring to a tzaddik which we usually call people a tzaddik. We're talking about a tzaddik in the ultimate definition. A tzaddik, the Alter Rebbe says in Perek Yudalet, is actually experiencing Olam Haba, the world to come, in Olam Hazeh, in this world. Olam Chet, exactly, Olam Chet Yir B'Chayach, as the Gemara says. The Gemara uses the expression in Brachas, Olam Chet Yir B'Chayach, you'll see in your lifetime the future world. And as you mentioned very correctly, in Olam Haba there is indeed no free choice. The Alter Rebbe explains it that there are certain unique individuals to whom Hashem granted Olam Haba when they are still in this world. They receive their reward while they're still in Olam Hazeh. Very few individuals, but there are those individuals. These tzaddikim are treading the path of Olam Hazeh, but in essence they are traveling the road of Olam Haba. So the issue of not having Bechira in and of itself, I don't think is so disturbing. But then there are the other issues we discussed earlier. Have a good day and a wonderful week.
Rabbi Jacobson delivers this weekly class on the Tanya each Sunday morning at Heichal Menachem in the Borough Park section of Brooklyn, New York. To order additional tapes or to receive the tapes weekly by mail, please call Heichal Menachem at 718-633-1076.